and welcome to the Rapid Microbiology Podcast, and I'm your host, Paul Carton. Today's topic is shelf life for the food industry and the guidelines food manufacturers need to follow when determining shelf life in products. With me today is Linda Everest, Principal Research Officer in Microbiology Safety and Spoilage at Camden BRI. Hi, Linda, and welcome to the Rapid Microbiology Podcast.
Hi, Paul. Thank you for inviting me to speak to you today.
Can we start with the basics, Linda? How do you define shelf life? For example, is it going to be the same for a new insect protein-based product as it would for a traditional pork pie?
So the shelf life is really defined as the time after a product's produced that it remains safe. So that means there's no issues with food safety, food poisoning, so you won't be making anyone ill. And also it relates to the quality that you'd expect. So it's got to remain exactly how you would expect it to be. So for chilled products, obviously that's going to be a much shorter life, and we'd apply a use-by date to those. So a use-by date is applied to products where there are potential food safety issues. For some products, there are no food poisoning risks, really. So that's really quality related, and they'd be given a best before. So what you do for any product, so whether it's a new insect protein or a pork pie, you look at the things like what is the pH, how much salt is there, what's the acidity, are there any preservatives, and importantly, how it's processed and packed. And you look at all those factors, and that helps you decide what shelf life it'd have, and also sort of how you'd go about the shelf life testing. All of these thought processes and things that you go through are the same for any of the product types, so it doesn't really matter what it is.
Okay, so canned products, they're quite safe, and is that because of the high temperature that they're brought to?
Yeah, that's right. They're expected to have no microbial issues, so their issues are more quality related. Okay. If you've got dried products, then there's just not enough water there, so the water activity is too low for organisms to grow. So you might have things in a dried product that might survive, but they won't grow throughout life.
Okay, and so used by, the term used by relates to microbiological issues, and the best before relates to quality and sensory.
Yeah, that's right. So if you've got a product where, so it's mainly the chilled products where there will be food safety issues. So you might have issues with potentially with Listeria or botulinum or some of the other organisms. And because chilling is your only factor, there's no heat involved or drying, then they are given a use by because there are safety issues.
Okay, there is organisms that still can survive in those psychotropic organisms.
Yeah, so you might have a product, say like a smoked salmon, where you might have Listeria there in low levels, and over time it might be able to grow to levels that would be more than 100. So that would be a risky level. Or you might have Staph aureus there that might grow to a level to give you toxin over time.
Okay. May I ask, what's the strangest food you've had to determine shelf life for?
We've done a lot of different foods over the time, but my colleague had a can of worms. So it was a can of dried mealworms to advise on the safety and potential spoilage.
Okay. I know the EU have recently did an evaluation of that recently, actually, and they've confirmed that there is no, it's quite a safe product to have on the market, despite allergic reactions that can come from it.
Yeah, I think we were just looking at it, the fact that it was dried and would there be any organisms that are there? Because I know there are issues, aren't they, with that type of thing as to whether it'd be a novel food and that sort of thing. But
okay.
But yeah.
Now, during the pandemic, shelf life is becoming especially important. Consumers are looking to reduce the amount of times they go to the supermarket for fear of infection, let's say, and perhaps quarantining their groceries in the garage when they come home, and are looking for this unrealistic expiry date on their bread, milk, etc. Is there a move to extend shelf life as much as possible?
Yeah, well, yes and no. Yes, as in our shopping habits have changed over the years. So whereas traditionally people would go to the shop every day, every other day and buy food for that day, obviously we now only go maybe once or twice a week. And obviously, as you've said, in the pandemic, you want to go as least as possible. Mm-hmm. So yes, there is a move to increase shelf life. That's why things like modified atmosphere packagings come in because it increases the life that you can get. There's also a move to look at when you've opened products, so especially ambient products, so like jam sauces and things, once they're opened, that if you chill them, will that extend the after open life? There's a move to look at freezing. So if you look at packets of frozen foods, there can be a discrepancy as to what it says. So it might say freeze on day of purchase, but it might also say freeze on day of end of life.
Okay.
So obviously, if you freeze on, if you've got a product and it's chilled and it says freeze on day of purchase, then you might be tempted to throw it away if you're not going to use it by the end of life. Whereas if you could freeze it, then obviously it extends it. But you do need to be a bit careful in that case, because if you freeze it on the day, the end of shelf life, and then it's thawed and then used at any point after, it's actually going beyond its original life.
It's quite confusing.
It is quite confusing. So there is a move to actually simplify that a bit. So yes, there is a move to extend life, but conflicting with that is we all want products with less salt, less sugar, less preservatives to make them more clean label and healthy. But as I said, first of all, things like salt, sugar, preservatives help extend shelf life. So if you remove salt, you remove sugar, you take out the preservatives, then you could well be reducing the shelf life. It's just a bit of a balance between the two, really.
Yeah, society wants extended shelf life, less waste, reduced antimicrobials, but this in itself is very difficult to achieve. So let's get into the practicalities. How should a manufacturer go about determining shelf life, and how much can processors influence that?
What you need to do is you need to work out the key factors that influence the shelf life. So where are your organisms and issues coming from? So you look at things like the ingredients, the pH, the water activity, if there's any preservatives, if the product's processed at all. That tells you what organisms are going to be present and which, if present, are likely to grow. So what you would do then is you have to, in the first instance, as part of HACCP and things, is to look at what pathogens are going to be present. Is there a risk of these food poisoning organisms or pathogens being able to grow? So what you can do in the first instance is look at microbial modelling. And that's a really quick, easy to use tool. So you could, for example, look to see if Listeria will grow under the conditions of your food and storage. That'll tell you whether it's likely to be a risk or not. You might also look at challenge testing. So that's where you take your organism of concern and inoculate it into the product. Again, store it and see whether it does grow. So you might want to do that for, say, Listeria, botulinum, any of the pathogens, really. Once you've established safety issues and what we would say is the safe shelf life, you can look at the quality issues. So that's probably what you'd mostly know as shelf life testing. So you'd have a look at what organisms are present in every batch. So it would tend to be more of your spoilage organisms. And then you store under realistic conditions. And this is where it gets quite interesting, because you have to think about what temperature the product would go through. So whilst you as a manufacturer have got it in your control and it's being distributed chilled, by chilled distribution and with the retailer, in the UK, we know that's quite well controlled and it's probably going to be around 5 degrees. At the point at which a consumer buys it, surveys and studies have shown that sort of 2 hours at 22 degrees is probably going to mimic buying the shopping in the shop, packing it, taking it home and putting it away. But then when you get to the consumer fridges, even though you might say on the pack, store at less than 4, less than 5. The Food Standards Agency say people know their fridges should be at 5. Well, they do, but in reality, a lot of the time, consumer fridges will be about 7. So the point at which the consumer might store your product in the fridge, you should be thinking about using a higher temperature. It will vary, obviously, product to product, but the general rule of thumb is usually about two thirds under manufacturer's control and about a third with the consumer.
Okay.
And what you also need to consider is, and this kind of links in with the phrasing as well, you probably want to test 20 to 25% beyond life, because you're always going to have that consumer that might think, oh, I'm not going back to the shop today. I'm going to use it. It's only one day out of life or 2 days out of life.
Yeah. The smell test.
Well, I wouldn't recommend that, but yes, pretty much. Test it beyond life. And then we were talking about freezing before and open shelf life, so you need to consider that as well. So if you're going to put any freezing instructions on the pack, you need to be sure that if you're putting freeze at point the last day of life, you're sure it'll be okay once they've thawed it, and perhaps put some thawing instructions after opening. Obviously, products have one life when they're closed and another one when they're open. And you might want to think about products like juices, butters, milk, things like that, where you might get it out of the fridge and then you might store it at ambient for 5-10
minutes. I'm definitely guilty of that, leaving it for 2 days in the winter time at the moment.
Yeah, well, it is pretty cold at the moment. So yeah, you need to also think about how the consumer will be sort of using the product.
Just to go back to what you were saying there about ambient temperatures, Linda, would the climate of another country come into consideration when determining shelf life, if you're exporting to hot countries?
Yes, it would. So there are, if you're doing the UK, then obviously chilled isn't so much of an issue. Ambient in the UK, we'd probably use about 25 degrees. If you're going to one of the hotter countries where it's a lot warmer and a lot more humid, then you might want to think about adding in humidity and temperature as a factor.
Okay.
That will affect the quality, especially.
That's good information. If someone wanted to find this information or seek advice on the use of new packaging or antimicrobials, where would they go?
Well, if you want general shelf life information and information on protocols to use, we've got our guideline 46 shelf life testing, which is available on the website. But in terms of the new antimicrobials and packaging types, we have a lot of expertise in packaging at Camden, so people can advise on that, because you need to think about things like, if you're using a new antimicrobial, what effect does it have on the life compared in new and old, and packaging as well. Mm-hmm. If you're swapping packaging and you're going for something, say, more biodegradable, more cardboard type, you'd need to think about what effect it has on the product, but also does it allow organisms in through the packaging and things like that.
Okay, let's move on to an organism that's a bit of a headline grabber, Listeria. It's a dangerous one, and it's caused many fatalities recently. And when we've seen a large increase of outbreaks associated with, it's a key pathogen for ready-to-eat products. So, how do manufacturers go about determining shelf life with reference to Listeria?
Yeah, Listeria is a key pathogen, and it's one of the only ones where there is a maximum legally permitted level. So, you can't have more than 100 CFU per grams in ready-to-eat foods. So what manufacturers will do is have a look at the risk of Listeria being present in their food. So they'd have a look at, do they ever find it in their products? Is it in their processing environment? So they'd have a look at their routine swabbing. And that all helps to see if Listeria is going to be a potential risk. If it is going to be a risk, then they may carry out modelling to see if it's going to grow. So if it was present, is it likely to get to more than 100? If it is, they would know they'd need absence. Once they've done the modelling, they then might want to back that up with inoculated challenge studies. So you inoculate Listeria into the product, test it under realistic conditions and see if it grows. So then you're sort of looking at, is the Listeria present in the product? Is it there in the environment? Will it grow via a challenge test? So you're looking at all these data, this data, and linking it together. And I'm managing a research project, one of the ones that we have at Camden, looking at all of these areas and linking them together. So if you've got a challenge test, how does that compare? If you don't have the challenge data, but you have predictions and environmental monitoring, Hopefully that should be released and published by the end of the year.
Okay, that's something to look forward to. Something you mentioned there about the challenge test, there's an update, I know, coming to the URL, Listeria Challenge Test Guidance. What's going to change here?
Yeah, that's the EURL is the challenge test procedure that's recommended by the European Reference Lab for Listeria. It gives you how you should carry out challenge testing. And one of the things that's changing is the consumer portion of storage. So at the moment, because this is a European document and it covers the cold countries like the UK, right through to the warmer ones, Spain, Italy, consumer storage can be or could be up to 12. So what we've done is we've looked and analysed data all across the EU, and that's now been reduced to 10 degrees C. So that third with the consumer will be at 10, unless you have national data. So I know for the UK and Ireland, we do have national data, and sort of 7-8 degrees is probably okay. And we would be able to use that data to say, in our situation, this is what the temperature would be for the consumer.
Okay, but what could go wrong? What if it's badly designed? What's the worst thing that can happen?
Probably the worst thing you can get wrong in a challenge test is an unrealistic temperature. So if you used 5 degrees throughout life, then you might find that Listeria won't grow quite as quickly. If we're talking about botulinum, it may not grow within the shelf life that you're assigning. But in reality, and as we've talked about before, we know that when the product is with the consumer, it isn't going to be stored at 5. It could be a lot higher than that. So if you then put it in a consumer's fridge, Listeria might grow to a higher level. Listeria botulinum, if it really didn't grow at 5, as soon as it gets to a higher temperature, will start growing quicker. So that's one of the things that can go wrong. And also things like choice of strains. With Listeria, there are some strains that grow better than others. So what we tend to do is adapt the strains up to the conditions that they will see in real life, and also try and use strains that have come from similar sort of products so that they're a little bit more adapted.
It's an ever-changing sector, really, isn't it, with all these new strains? Do you see a lot of variation as evolution goes on?
Yeah, you can see strains, and obviously you have new and emerging organisms. So like 30 years ago, there was no E. coli 0157, but we have that now. Strains adapt to the conditions. So yeah, it's important to make sure that you've considered that when you're doing a challenge test, because it has to be realistic to what the product might encounter.
Sure. How do Camden BRI help industry with these shelf life related issues?
Well, we've got experts across the site covering many, many fields. So we've got experts that can look at things like food safety systems and HACCP. And we've got people that can look at packaging and labelling. Myself, I look at designing challenge tests, shelf life studies. We can do predictive modelling. So basically, we can cover and help with the whole aspect of shelf life and challenge tests. I work quite closely with some of our sensory team. So I might do the micro and they might look at the sensory quality. We've got chemists, so sometimes I link with them. So we do the micro, they do the chemistry. So we can cover all aspects.
Okay. Now I know advanced microbial profiling. I know it's something it's not in your expertise, but can you, for our listeners, just explain what it is?
Yeah. Well, AMP, or Advanced Microbial Profiling, is a new technique, so it's developed over the last few years. And rather than look for the organisms itself, you're looking for the microbial DNA. So when you're looking for the organism itself, so traditional microbial methods, you design it to be optimal for the organism you're looking for. So you look at the food and you decide what organism might be present, and then you use the media and growth conditions to allow you to try and get that organism out of the product. But with that, you're kind of selecting for certain groups of organisms. But with the AMP, you're looking for DNA. So it isn't selective as such. So it will just find all of the DNA that's present. So you might find that there's organisms in there that that you wouldn't have emptied out using the traditional techniques. So it won't necessarily give you levels and numbers like you would do if you're doing traditional microbial testing, but it will give you an idea of whether you've got large proportions of lactic acid bacteria or the Enterobacteriaceae, or it's been used where people have looked for particular types of cheeses. Do they have the cultures they should have? Fermented products, is it the right starter culture? And you can look at it for factory hygiene as well. So are you finding the same sort of proportions and organisms coming through from your environment into your product? So it's a useful technique, and my colleagues at Camden BRI are developing and working on this at the moment.
Okay, brilliant. And something you've touched on already, predictive microbiology. Can you explain what that is?
So predictive micro has been around sort of 25, 30 years. So it's where you develop computer models for pathogens, spoilage organisms, and you input things like pH, salt level, temperature into a computer model, and it generates a bacterial growth curve for you. So what you do is you generate in the lab, say 150 conditions, and then someone really clever at statistics will then put an equation to that. So it will take all of the lag times, growth rates, maximum levels achieved, put those all together for those conditions you've tested, and then allow you to be able to predict what happens within the conditions you haven't tested. So if you've done only 5, 10 and 15 degrees C for temperature, it'll allow you to predict 5, 5.1, 5.2 and so on. And by the time you add in salt and pH, you can do, say, 150 conditions, but it'll allow you to predict thousands. And obviously no one has got the time then to sit and put all these things into these really long equations. So what you do is you pass that to a computer programmer who will develop an easy-to-use interface for you. So you just click or add in your pH, salt, temperature, and it will generate it for you and give you the curve. So all of the hard stuff is done. It's really useful, and I've mentioned it before. So you can say, if I start with a level of 10 listeria, how long will it take to get to 100? More botulinum grow in my product. If you want to look at staph and bacillus cereus, we know that it needs to get to certain levels before it produces toxins. So how long will it take to reach those levels? So it's a really quick, easy, cheap tool to use, and it gives you an idea of what's going to happen without having to do the practical testing in a lot of detail. There's systems as well for things like ambient sources. So you wouldn't want to be putting those up through a 12-month shelf life trial and then deciding that the formulation wasn't right 6 months in. So you can get a really good and quick answer as to whether things are likely to grow or not.
Okay, sounds like a very useful tool to have in your toolkit, and one that's going to be, it's probably a common tool amongst manufacturers and processors. Thank you very much, Linda, for highlighting the importance of shelf life testing for manufacturers and processors. It's definitely a topic worthy of attention, considering the times we're living in. Thank you, Linda.
Thank you very much.
And thank you to the listener for making the time.